Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to the program today, If You Love This Planet. We're interviewing media critic Jeff Cohen, who's the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's an associate professor of journalism. His latest book is Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. He has been a TV commentator at CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, and was senior producer of MSNBC's Phil Donahue primetime show until it was terminated 3 weeks before the Iraq invasion for political reasons. Cohen founded the media watch group FAIR, F-A-I-R, in 1986. His columns on media issues have been published online at such websites as Huffington Post, Common Dreams, Alternet, and dozens of dailies, including USA Today, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Atlanta Constitution, and Miami Herald. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Great to be with you, Helen.
Let's start with the fiasco with Phil Donahue, you and MSNBC and me, just before the Iraq invasion, which I think illustrates what actually happened to you and the pressures on you and Phil Donahue at that time.
Well, everything about it was pretty peculiar. I mean, you rarely hear of a television network that cancels its most watched program. And Phil Donahue Primetime was the most watched program on MSNBC at the time. As I describe in my book, I'd spent months arguing with the top brass at MSNBC, saying if you let Phil Donahue be Phil Donahue, and you let us be the one place that dissents from the Bush administration cheerleading on national television, we will have huge ratings. And the reality is that at that time, in 2002, 2003, they were less interested in building ratings than they were tamping down controversy. So, you know, you look at the situation now where they have Rachel Maddow, her ratings are through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Olbermann, ratings through the roof. And, you know, I feel very vindicated when I see these liberal, anti-Bush type voices that have grown with this audience. It's exactly what I was arguing in 2002 and 2003. And I really hate it when I hear, even in liberal circles, people giving credit to these executives at MSNBC. I mean, these are the same people that suppressed dissent and debate and journalism when it really mattered before our young men and women were sent overseas to kill or be killed. That's when these executives were just practicing censorship.
Why did they do it, Jeff? Tell me the reason.
There's never one reason. I think there were about three or four reasons. One factor is that no one in the mainstream media wants to be apart from the herd. It's basically a conformist medium, television news.
That's pathetic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very sad. And they were afraid, you know, when Phil Donahue would get some dissenting voices on the air, you know, they'd get a few letters saying this program's anti-American. And instead of doing what journalists would do, which is, you know, put those letters and emails aside and let their journalists search for truth and facts, they caved. Another factor is in that period, all the major media conglomerates had their lobbyists on Capitol Hill going to the Bush administration, lobbying for a change in the regulations that would allow these few huge media corporations to get even huger. And it wasn't clear to us at the time that that was a factor. Mm. But when we started getting very, very strange orders from top management at MSNBC, and then, you know, a few months after we were all terminated, we realized that at that point, MSNBC wouldn't allow even 1 hour of critical programming because they didn't want to do anything that could get in the way of General Electric and its lobbyists, you know, getting these rules changed, these regulations changed, these FCC, Federal Communications.
Did they get them changed?
The reason they didn't get them changed is because the anti-war movement on the internet, led by groups like Move On and Free Press and others, were so huge by the after the war started in the spring and summer of 2003 that the FCC got more criticism and critical emails that the thing never really went fully through, that the pro-business obliterating of all regulations did not happen because of a popular intervention that had never happened before around a media policy issue in our country.
Thank God.
So that was another factor. I think there's another factor that I think you're familiar with from your work in our country in the 80s, which is just old-fashioned Joe McCarthyism. That, you know, there's this sense in the mainstream media that you can have any right-wing nut on the air, like the Falwells and the Ann Coulters, over and over and over. But if you have, you know, even mainstream articulate progressives, then, you know, this legacy, remember American television started during the Joe McCarthy era. There's always been this fear on the part of executives of having the left wing heard from, whereas they're never fearful of having the ultra right wing heard from day after day after day.
Yes.
So I think there was a series of factors.
Yes, I will get into that in a minute with Rush Limbaugh. I wanted to recall, though, the episode with me and Phil Donahue, who I love and have, you know, been on his show many a time.
Yep.
You were buzzing around in the green room and I was there and I was to have, I think, 15 minutes. I'd just written the book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military Industrial Complex, which was probably the first book written to warn people about what would happen if America went into Iraq. The weapons to be used, the corporations involved, the whole catastrophe. Didn't get a lot of publicity, but Phil was going to have me on. Anyway, it turned out that, if you remember, there were two parents talking about their Siamese twins and they were going to have 20 minutes and they went on and on. Not that it wasn't important, you know, a sort of interesting story, but it went on and on and on. And in the end, I mean, I was ready to tear my hair out because what we were to discuss was so important. I got 5 minutes. Do you remember that, Jeff?
Yeah, but see, that was typical. That, remember, I mean, the people that worked on Donahue's staff were very solid people, but they were under intense pressure to go to the human interest stories and get away from dissenting authors like you. I mean, the orders were explicit. And,
were they? Were they really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, week after week, we were told during different phases. I describe all of this in the book, but during different phases, we were given different orders, and a lot of the orders were basically emphasize celebrity and human interest and get away from, you know, hardcore political social issues.
Because
I must tell you this.
What?
By the very end, you know, in the last few months of Donahue, we were given orders that every time we booked one guest who was anti-war, we had to book two that were pro-war.
Two?
Yeah. If we booked two guests on the left, we needed three on the right. There was one meeting where a producer said she was thinking of booking Michael Moore as a guest, and she was told she'd have to have three right-wingers for balance.
That is revolting.
Yeah.
Because the media,
that order was given week after week.
The media actually orchestrated that war, and according to The Lancet, the British medical journal, over 1 million civilians have been killed, and there are many of them are children, and there are 4 million refugees, 2 million internal within Iraq, and 2 million externally gone to Lebanon and other places. I mean, what America has done has just been so obscene, and it's really still not talked about in big terms, is it, Jeff?
No, No, I mean, I don't know that we'll ever get a firm number on the huge numbers of civilians that were killed. The refugees are a little easier to get a count of. I mean, the country has been wrecked. And in the U.S. media today, the argument is, well, the surge worked. It took a while, but peace has come to Iraq, and it's not a big controversy anymore. It's always this pacifying, you know,
it's
the pacifying voice.
Yeah, even the New York Times, which I read every day because there's some good stuff in that, and the Washington Post, they follow that line too. You know, there's no sewage system. There's sewage in the streets. During Hussein's time, the two countries in the Middle East who had the lowest infant mortality and the highest literacy rate were Libya and Iraq. And, you know, and the doctors were fantastic. I mean, the operating rooms were attacked. Surgeons and the patients on the tables. They killed the doctors. They killed... the electricity comes on maybe 2 hours a day. And this is when they say, well, we've won the war in Iraq.
Right, it's relative peace. I think you're right that, you know, you're in a country and most people in the world can turn on the news and actually see the devastation of Iraq. We don't see it in our television news. It's not, you don't see the pictures of civilians. You don't see the toll. All you see is the line of the day. And the line of the day, and I would argue that Obama is somewhat complicit in this, the line of the day is that, well, you know, it took a while, but our soldiers have ultimately brought some peace to the country.
Peace.
And,
they've stolen the country, and I think it's fairly clear they've stolen the oil. And, in fact, isn't that really, Jeff Cohen, the main reason that America invaded Iraq to get access to the oil, which had been nationalized and owned by the Iraqi people, by Hussein?
Well, I'll tell you that I agree with Chomsky and others who say that if the main product in Iraq had been, say, Brussels sprouts, there never would have been an invasion. That's one way of putting it. I think, again, there's several factors. I think another reason for the invasion was the neoconservatives wanted to get permanent military bases into the region. I think there's just there was an effort to want to throw the weight around to show we're the single superpower. There's always several geopolitical reasons, but if that country's main product was not oil, but it was, you know,
broccoli,
cabbage, you know, there would not have been an invasion, and I don't think anyone in the world seriously believes there would have been.
But the retrospective analysis is so superficial and so dishonest.
But see, Helen, you mentioned two newspapers that were instrumental in the invasion happening. And in particular, two pages. The front page of the New York Times had article after article by Judith Miller. Or Judith Miller and Michael Gordon together. And those articles were sheer total fantasy. And they were they didn't have named sources. Almost all of them were anonymous intelligence sources, anonymous Bush White House sources. At the time the stories were published, there were experts on Iraq that said this story, it's hard to refute it because there's no sources, but it just doesn't ring right. And the Times kept publishing
those
articles.
Even the State Department said that.
Well, there were people inside, government agencies that were sometimes trying to knock down what was on the front page of the Times. But the important thing to understand about the New York Times front page is it's the most edited page in our country that... you don't get on the front page of the Times without several people looking at it, deciding it belongs there. So it wasn't just a failure of one reporter or two reporters. It was a failure of the whole news editing staff. And the same thing, you go over to the Washington Post, they had 36 pro-invasion editorials in the months leading up to the invasion. And their op-ed page, which is supposed to have diverse views, was also extremely hawkish. You know, when Al Gore made a speech questioning the wisdom of invading Iraq, he was called name after name on the page of the op-ed page of the Washington Post.
So what was the raison d'etre for the Post to be so hawkish in pushing the invasion? What was it, Jeff Cohen?
Well, I think that they've become enthralled to this ideology of interventionism and sort of a soft neoconservatism. Part of it is, you know, part of the whole neoconservative outlook is this idea that anything that's good for the state of Israel mm-hmm. is good for the U.S. and global peace and human rights. It's this idea where what's good for Israel and protecting Israel, that should be the almost the number one goal, our number one focus. And there's some of these people, and I started seeing this in the 1970s, some of these people who used to be doves and thought that the military budget was too big, well, now the military budget can never be big enough.
Yeah.
And so I think there's an interventionist streak and tendency, especially around the Middle East, that comes from these Israel right or wrong, I can only call them fanatics or extremists.
Mm.
And I think that's a part of it when you look at places like the New Republic that endorsed the invasion
mm.
or the Washington Post editorial page that so endorsed the invasion. When you look at those people that are not normally right-wing on everything, but mm. they're right-wing on the Middle East, it's that neoconservative ideology that, frankly, these people don't know much about the Middle East. They think, you know, the more violence, the more militarism, somehow one day, hasn't happened yet, but one day the Arabs and the Muslims will submit. And if they haven't submitted yet, we just haven't used enough force. I mean, frankly, if those people stay in power, and many of them are within the Obama administration, then the whole future world peace is in jeopardy.
Yeah, they wrote The People for a New American Century, didn't they? Which was a very
some of those Project for a New American Century.
Project for a New, very outstandingly scary. You can Google that document. Who are the neocons then, Jeff Cohen, who are in Obama's staff?
Well, Obama has a bunch of people. I mean, an obvious one is the guy named Ross.
Yes, Dennis Ross.
Dennis Ross, of course, he left the Clinton White House. Mm. And then he was a Mideast expert for Fox News for years.
Mm.
And total hawk, and he's back in.
Yep.
You have a bunch of folks around, you know, that are the kinds of people that were writing the op-eds in the Washington Post that are Democratic Party hawks.
George Mitchell is a good guy, though, and he's in charge.
Yeah, and
of
Mitchell
the...
is very, and Mitchell is very had to go through some tough criticism. You know what his flaw, according to these writers, he's even-handed.
God!
You know that again, if you're even-handed between Israel and Palestine, then you're suspect. Now, how can you bring peace to the region if you're not even-handed? But people were attacking Mitchell because of the, you know, he was under suspicion for, quote, even-handedness. I mean, look at the attacks on this guy Freeman, you know, up for an intelligence post. He's been the subject of a relentless attack in generally liberal places, the New Republic, Atlantic, and it's because he is seen as someone who is not Israel right or wrong, that Israel isn't always correct, and they're frying him over it, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with him. Charles Freeman.
Well, it's interesting, too, to watch Obama. Headlines in our paper yesterday, Sydney Morning Herald, actually it was the article from the New York Times, Obama seemingly wants to talk to the Taliban. I mean, this is a very interesting character, and I think he sort of plays both sides of an issue, but I think within himself he's got fairly determined guidelines and policies which we will see enacted over time. Do you agree with that, Jeff Cohen?
I guess I'm a little more skeptical of him than you. I've never been the one who drank the Obama Kool-Aid. I've always seen him as sort of a conventional corporate centrist voice. Mm. His appointments have been almost universally disappointing. Jeremy Scahill, if anyone Googles it, has written a story about his appointments on the foreign policy area, which Jeremy called a kettle of hawks.
Oh, dear.
And on the,
how do you spell
the,
Scahill?
S-C-A-H-I-L-L, Jeremy Scahill. I mean, he's a bunch of people have written articles in the period from November through January, February about who these appointments are, and a lot of them, you know, they're not hard neocons, but some of them are soft neocons. And what was really interesting is, I know during the political campaign, during the Democratic primary, when the Obama team or Obama himself was trying to get a liberal or an anti-war person to come out and endorse him and stand against the Hillary Clinton campaign, the argument that was used over and over was, look, every single foreign policy advisor of the Obama campaign was against invading Iraq, and every one of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy advisors was for invading Iraq. And then an odd thing happened. As soon as Hillary dropped out of the race, and Obama felt it was crucial, the Obama campaign felt it was crucial to come across as anti-war, because that's where the sentiment of the country is and was. But every single foreign policy person they took on from then on had supported the invasion.
That's very
from the
strange.
Vice presidential pick, Biden,
yep.
who not only supported the invasion, he was instrumental in the invasion when he was the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And then you could even go to people that didn't quite make it in because of tax scandals, like Daschle. Was the majority leader of the Democrats when he paved the way for the invasion of Iraq. He could so easily have held up a vote on Iraq, but Daschle allowed a vote to happen before there was real debate and allowed it to happen right before the November 2002 election.
Yeah.
So you had one after another of these people that like were brought into the administration as soon as Hillary was gone and they no longer had to try to use the anti-war argument against Hillary, you had them basically taking all the Hillary people, including Dennis Ross, who's one of the most fanatically anti-peace forces when it comes to Israel and Palestine inside the, I guess he's still inside the Democratic Party. Who knows when you spend years featured, week after week on Fox News Channel.
I'm interviewing Jeff Cohen, media critic, who is the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College and associate professor of journalism. I've known Jeff for probably over 20 years, and he's one of the few people who is an outstanding independent journalist and has watched the evolution of independent journalists over time. Let's talk about the need for independent journalists and independent media at this time in the United States, Jeff Cohen.
Well, the good news is that while the mainstream media, especially daily newspapers, are in complete financial crisis, and of course a spiritual crisis that I don't think they've ever gotten through, given the cheerleading around the war in Iraq, as the mainstream media have been suffering a spiritual, political, financial crisis in the last, say, 6-7 years, the independent media growth has been astounding.
Has it?
You have a bunch of blogs that started in 2002 based heavily on skepticism about invading Iraq, And those blogs like came out of nowhere and took off. I'm thinking of places like Daily Coast, which is one of the hugest blogs in America today.
DailyCoast.com. Yeah.
And then and another is Atrios, A-T-R-I-O-S. You can just Google any of these. And, they started in 2002, and within a couple years, because the mainstream media cheerleading for Iraq was so bad, even on that one issue, and it's not the only issue these blogs dealt with, even on that issue, people built up a certain trust. Like, isn't it interesting that the independent media got the facts right about Iraq and the mainstream media, the so-called professionals, got the facts so wrong? And, look at Amy Goodman's show. She started 12 years ago, Democracy Now!, heard on Pacifica and so many TV and radio stations across the country and the world. you know, she started basically out of a broom closet at the New York Pacifica station 12 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, BAI. And, you know, she's built that into the biggest public media collaboration today, seen on television, seen on radio, seen on satellite television, seen on the web. I mean, it started as radio. Now it's radio and television. I think you look around and you see, gee, these independent journalists are maybe more trustworthy on big issues of war and peace, environmental degradation, corporate corruption. And I think it's been, you know, like at the Park Center for Independent Media, which I run at Ithaca College, we're giving out the first annual awards named after the independent muckraking journalist I.F. Stone, Izzy Stone. We're calling them the Izzy Awards. And the award is being shared this year by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And this incredible blogger named Glenn Greenwald. And Glenn is another amazing success story in independent media. He'd been a constitutional lawyer up until 2005, an attorney. He knew that one area really well. He was a litigator. And then he started blogging. I mean, it was like the Bush, you know, shredding the U.S. Constitution that got him into blogging. And now, in 2009, he's one of the most respected writers in America today. When, you know, if you go online, you can see senators and Congress members quoting him on the floor of Congress.
Oh.
He didn't start operating as a journalist, you know, commentator, blogger until 4 years ago. And he's, again, there's no one who's quicker to dig up the prior statements of a huge media figure, a huge political figure, to show how that person is being dishonest today. There's no one who's better at it and quicker at it than Glenn Greenwald. He posts almost every day, and then he keeps updating his post, which is something that bloggers can do. He gets a lot of tips. This is another beauty of independent media, a more direct relationship with your community.
Yes.
You know, in corporate mainstream media, they look at their people as consumers, as customers, as audience.
Yeah.
But in the independent media, you know, there's such an intimate relationship with your community, and you find that so many of these bloggers are getting rich information and tips and insights on an hourly basis from their readers, and then that becomes part of the conversation. And that's something new. You know, one of the people we had speak at Ithaca College, one of the recent heroes of independent media, is another blogger known as Josh Marshall, and his blog is called Talking Points Memo. And Josh Marshall, you know, he started during the time of the Florida recount in 2000. He was the proverbial blogger in his pajamas.
Yeah.
And, you know, just doing it part-time at night.
Yes.
But over the years, he built this thing up where when he needed help, his community of readers would send him research. When he needed money to cover, like, the New Hampshire primary in 2004, they donated money so he could buy a car and go up to New Hampshire. And so by 2006, 2007, he's hired other people to do investigative work with him. And they're the ones who grew suspicious when they heard that one of the federal prosecutors in 2007 had been fired by the Bush White House, and they started relying on their readers, their community. They said, hey, has anyone heard of anything else that's sort of suspicious? And over a period of months, the Talking Points Memo blog started crusading about this issue of politically motivated firings of federal prosecutors by the Bush White House. And it ended up leading to the U.S. Attorney General having to resign. So, you know, think about it. Like 20, 30 years ago, if a cabinet member resigned, it was usually because maybe the New York Times or the Washington Post had deployed a number of reporters and they dug up a scandal. Well, here you have bloggers working with their community who brought down a U.S. Attorney General. If it wasn't for the Talking Points memo and these independent bloggers, it's possible that story never would have gotten out. So you have the New York Times and the Washington Post sort of having to play catch up after a bunch of bloggers dig the story up.
Do you think then that the conventional media, like the Times and the Post and the, you know, the networks, have any understanding of what's happening and how they're being left so far behind and actually losing money because of it, because they're just not really in the mainstream at all?
Well, I think some of them do. And, you know, these are huge institutions.
Yeah.
And there's some smart people and some dumb people at every institution. But, I mean, I was surprised when I saw, and pleasantly surprised, that one of the most important pages of the New York Times is the letters page, and the second most important is the op-ed page.
Yep.
They ran about 4 or 5 weeks ago, they had an op-ed on the New York Times, which said that maybe the way to save daily newspapers, which are so struggling in this country and elsewhere, is to endow them as nonprofit, independent institutions like universities and colleges. And, you know, that's an argument that progressives and independents have been making for a long time, that not only is it a way of saving these publications, it's a way of putting them on a new independent footing. And, you know, daily newspapers are so crucial to covering a city hall, covering a state capitol, covering Washington. Some of the better newspapers have some very good reporters still employed by them. But I just thought it was a real breakthrough when even mainstream thought is, let's save a few of these newspapers as nonprofits, try to get them endowed, and that way, imagine how journalists could be unleashed.
Well, now, why can't they be unleashed now? And I think of I.F. Stone and Walter Lippmann and others who and Murrow, who spoke and wrote the truth. I mean, what is it now that holds them back? Is it the shareholders? I mean, why are they conservative?
Well, I think there is that problem of that corporate ownership. That if
what do you mean? I don't understand.
Well,
how
I'll
it
give
operates.
You an example. I'll give you an example. In the early '90s, and you know, I was at FAIR at the time, the Media Watch Group. We started seeing, and it's happening again as Obama talks about healthcare. But when the Clintons were talking about healthcare reform in the early '90s, we were sort of stunned that instead of covering the news and covering the various options that were being put forward in the 1990s for healthcare reform, including one plan that was endorsed by 100 members of Congress, which was for basically enhanced Medicare for all, a national nonprofit national health insurance, single payer.
Mm.
They wouldn't cover it. And
who's
the
they?
Coverage, the Times.
Yeah.
And the coverage was just purely propagandistic. It wasn't even, there was not even a pretense of covering the news. It was more like they were dictating a parting line. And so we did a lot of research at the time, and we found that on the board of the New York Times, the corporate board, were several people who were also on the boards of giant pharmaceutical companies.
Oh.
Several of them were on the boards of big insurers.
Mm.
And I just think that when you have those, again, I don't think the board was calling up members of, you know, who are writing these stories, but just to have those kinds of people as your owners, I think it, and I worked at MSNBC, as I've already described you at the beginning of this conversation, that, you know, the sense of fear in the newsroom when I was there was palpable.
Really?
So I just think that the fact that these giant corporations own the TV networks, and more mid-sized corporations own the newspapers, but they are all intertwined with the Wall Street firms, and they're intertwined with the insurance firms and the pharmaceutical firms. It's that sort of corporate
incestuousness.
Like gallows,
it's if you look at the boards of the Washington Post, New York Times, and all the rest, the directors interdigitate. They have similar directors who just move from board to board at the same time. So, you know, it's all sort of tied up.
Yeah, and, it's interlocking.
And it's interlocking, and we're seeing the results, of course, of unrestrained capitalism and unrestrained deregulation now, which is bringing the world to its knees.
And keep in mind that deregulation was not just pushed by the right wing or the right-wing media, that much of the deregulation in the area of Wall Street was pushed by the New York Times.
And, oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And you know, and a lot of the deregulation, there's a new study, a crucial study, you should have him on your show, by Robert Weissman of Essential Information. He did a study of 12 major decisions that have been made in the last 10 years that directly led us to the financial collapse that we're in. And a number of those steps were taken by the Clinton administration, and it decisions that were pushed by people like Larry Summers, who's in the Obama administration.
Yeah.
Decisions that were pushed by other people from Merrill Lynch and from Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
And you find that these, and remember, no candidate in history ever received more money from Wall Street than Obama did.
Oh,
so I think the same old people tend to be in power. And even with this like complete collapse as you describe it, I mean, we can identify what decisions were taken and who took them and who pushed them and what editorial pages pushed these things. And it's not a pretty picture, but it's too easy to say, well, it was all Bush, Reaganite deregulation.
Yes.
No,
yes.
It wasn't just
yes.
that.
Yes, it was a combined effort. I'm interviewing media critic Jeff Cohen, who's the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media. Jeff, then, we've talked about the corporate media. Let's get on to NPR and PBS.
Yep.
What are your comments about that?
Well, very disappointing. You know, NPR and PBS have been so disappointing that, in other countries that have a higher level of political discourse, it's because public broadcasting is more independent, is more willing to take some chances, has some critical documentaries with regularity. I mean, when there's quality stuff on public TV, it's usually exception to the rule. It's people like Bill Moyers. It's an occasional documentary. But most of its public affairs content is conservative and corporate. And the major daily news show on public TV is called The News Hour.
Yeah.
And Helen, in the 1980s, you might remember that Jim Lehrer, who still runs The News Hour, Jim Lehrer, when producers would come to him, and I heard this from four different producers of the public TV News Hour in the 1980s, people would come. Producers would come to Lehrer and suggest, look, there's this huge freeze movement. There's this huge sentiment in the country. We're thinking of having one of the leaders on. And Jim Lehrer's reaction was, oh, you're not going to stick us with one of those moaners or whiners, are you?
Jesus.
So that was references to people like you. And so
who helped to mobilize 80% of the Americans to oppose the arms race?
Well, of course. I mean, if they had a real debate in our country, any of these points along the last 25 years, maybe we wouldn't have, you know, a military budget that can compete with all other countries combined. Maybe there'd be some sanity in U.S. foreign and military policy. But if you block a debate year after year, even when there's this huge grassroots movement that people like you were so instrumental in building, and you can't get in even public TV's News Hour, then you see the problem. And again, the problem continues today. FAIR did a study of the News Hour, and it was in about, I think, 2006, when the country had totally moved against the Iraq War, and most people wanted the troops out. And FAIR did a study of the guest experts that were on the public TV News Hour, and for every one guest who was advocating withdrawal, they had more than five guests that were advocating stay the course. And again, the majority of the country was on one side, and the hawkish minority got the dominant position on the public TV News Hour.
Well, that reminds me of when I was on Oprah. I met Rosie O'Donnell. I met Rosie O'Donnell. She said, do you want to go on Oprah? So she got me on Oprah. They interviewed me really carefully for half an hour, and I'd just written my book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's military-industrial complex. They put me on, and I was a grainy, gray image. I got 3 minutes just saying I thought we'd never been closer to nuclear war than we are now. They had that guy Pollock, who wrote a book about needing to go into Iraq, and another man in a suit who wrote a book going to into Iraq, and one of them had the cheek to say, yes, that's why we need to invade Iraq.
Yep.
I rang the producer and I said, I have never been so abused and used in that way. And he said, well, you are lucky to get on in the first place. And it's not clear to me where one turns in a situation like that where hundreds of thousands of people are about to be killed. And, you know, people like Oprah go along with it.
Yeah. If you remember, there was a one of the, I think it was Pollack, who went on the Oprah show. It might have been that very show.
Yeah.
And he said that Saddam not only has the capability of using weapons of mass destruction in the region, but he could actually strike the U.S. in our homeland, in the 48 states. And that kind of lunacy, that kind of extremism, was masquerading as mainstream thought.
And now he's against the Iraq war, and everyone still kowtows to him and bows down in front of him.
claims he's against the war. A big part of my book, Cable News Confidential, is who was able to speak during that crucial period you're describing, and who was pushed off into the margins or silenced altogether.
Yes, I was.
And, it's not a pretty picture, but it shows what happens if the corporate mainstream marginalizes dissent.
Mm.
The good news is that as we look back over the last 5 or 6 years, there are certain independent media outlets that you can look at, and you can look at their historical record and say, boy, the things that these people were talking about has come true, and the stuff that was said on MSNBC in 2002-03, on CNN in 2002-03, even Oprah's show, and clearly public TV. You know, we haven't talked about public radio, but during the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, they had very few dissenting views.
Yeah.
The national news that comes out of New York and Washington is extremely timid, elite, establishment. And, at the time, people were referring to NPR as National Pentagon Radio.
Or the National Petroleum Radio.
It was so biased.
Yes, well, and the other thing is that they take ads now. You know, they call it underwriting, which is a euphemism for ads. Once you take ads, you lose your independence.
Yeah, I think that public broadcasting in our country was sort of deformed at the get-go when it was determined that instead of the proposal that had come from a blue ribbon Carnegie Commission, which said you have to have independent insulated funding, right at the very beginning in the late 60s, a Dixiecrat congressman went to Lyndon Johnson and said, no, we're going to get to appropriate. And by that threat of cutting down or cutting off the funds to public TV and public radio is a way they've been able to enforce timidity. And as you say, by being the country in the advanced industrial world where a smaller per capita amount of our taxes, per capita funding from the public to public broadcasting, we're like less than every other advanced industrial country. That's what allows the so-called public broadcasters to justify going to these big corporations and getting call enhanced underwriting.
And in particular, I've been absolutely incensed by NPR in the last few years running ads pro-nuclear power. And I know the man in Washington who's the director of NPR, and he was quite nice and received me well. And I said, what are you running these ads for? You know, this is medically untrue. They wouldn't change, nor would they put on me or anyone else giving us equal time to negate what those ads from the Nuclear Research Institute were saying.
Yeah. No, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, there's so many double standards in public broadcasting in our country. You know, at public television, they have big corporations that underwrite programs about Wall Street, about business, and that's considered okay.
Yeah.
But when programmers have gone to public TV and said, we want to do this show about workplace issues and we're getting some of our funding, not all of it, but some of our funding from labor unions, they were told, well, no, we can't have that program on the air. So, in other words, a business program funded by corporate interest is okay. Mm. A workplace program funded by labor unions is not okay on so-called public broadcast.
Yes, I remember in the early 80s, I went as president of Physicians for Social Responsibility to ABC and said, we want to run an ad on the medical implications of nuclear war. And suddenly into the room came a man in a charcoal grey pinstripe suit, and he was the lawyer. And he said, yep. Well, what's your bottom line? And I was sort of taken aback because as a doctor, we needed to talk about the medical effects of nuclear war. And I stumbled around for a while and then I said, well, I suppose it's nuclear disarmament. He said, that's controversial, and he refused to run it.
You know, and yet, if you look at these TV networks, they're always running message ads. I mean, every hour I'm watching on these TV networks today, thankfully you're probably avoiding it, I'm seeing these ads for clean coal.
Oh, yeah.
And
another lie.
Complete propaganda. Everyone knows it.
It's like a safe nuclear war.
Yeah. I mean, but the good news is, not all of the networks, but I see at least on CNN, they're running an ad attacking this whole concept of clean coal.
Yeah, that's by the Cohen brothers.
Yeah, but I mean, it's funny that, you know, because CNN is often taking ads from one side and not the other,
yeah.
But at least on clean coal, they're taking ads from both sides. But on some TV networks, I just keep seeing these corporate paid for clean coal propaganda ads. And of course, they wouldn't let you have an ad.
Even at a time when capitalism is collapsing. Now, let's talk about the phenomenon of Rush Limbaugh, which is absolutely topical at the moment. Jeff, just go, Jeff Cohen, just talk about it. Who the man is, how long has he been on, how many listeners he has, and what he's up to.
Limbaugh has somewhere between 500 and 600 radio stations. People guess at his audience because there's a lot of hype. It's probably around 15 million people, I think, a week. And
I was saying 20 million people the other day.
No, I'm not sure that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say somewhere between 15 and 18.
Right.
That's my best guess. And, you know, I've been studying him since the 90s. I don't think he's as big as he was at his height, but he's still huge. And then, you know, after him is Sean Hannity's number two. It's a real dominance on corporate TV talk and corporate radio talk, the dominance of the right wing. I mean, Limbaugh is a guy who needs to be a monologuist. He can't win a debate.
Can't he?
Well, he doesn't deal, in fact, he doesn't allow debates. He doesn't go on shows where he has to debate. And he doesn't, and he's admitted that he doesn't have callers on to debate. That's not what he does. He admits that. He said it year after year.
Mm.
And what's important about Limbaugh is, and why I think his audience is aging and he's not able to replace it with younger
people. Oh, they're aging.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of young people, they get their, and this is a good thing, they get most of their news on the internet.
Yeah.
They're not, you know. So, I mean, think about the difference between Limbaugh and a blogger.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when a blogger, whether on the left wing or right wing or in the center, if you attack something and you say, and you quote from it, you have to link to the totality of it. And if the people reading your blog don't see a link, then they grow suspicious that you don't really have the goods.
Mm.
In other words, if the blogger hasn't made it easy for you to look at what the other side is saying, the side you're criticizing, then you lose credibility as a blogger.
Oh.
And so these bloggers, there's a lot of good debates between right and left and left and center in the blogosphere. It's a much higher level of debate than you see on TV and radio because people have to have sources. And if you claim there's a study, if you claim there's an article that backs up your point, you have to link to it. And if you don't, you know, no one's going to believe you in the current era of at least intelligent blogosphere, which is thankfully where millions of people getting their news. Now, go back to Limbaugh. When we put out our book on him in the 90s, he would do things like this. He would say, folks, I'm not making this up. The Clintons have their kid, Chelsea, she goes to a school where all the eighth graders are forced to write an essay, Why I Feel Guilty Being White, unquote. And I'm not making this stuff up. My source is CBS News. Now, in the 90s, we didn't have a blogosphere in the early 90s.
Mm.
And so most people, it sounded credible. He has a source, you know, and he was always doing that.
Mm.
I'm not making this stuff up, folks. There's a study at Tufts University in Massachusetts that says the bigger a woman's breast size, the lower her IQ.
Oh.
Not making it, you know. And so when we were doing this book, you know, every time we saw, I'm not making this up, I have a source, we would go track down the source.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was no such study at Tufts University. There was no article. And, you know, CBS News had never reported that Chelsea Clinton's school, you had to write an article, I'm guilty being white. And so we were able to show that this guy is a charlatan.
He's a liar.
Yeah, well, he makes stuff up.
Yeah.
He's a charlatan. And when he says, I'm not making this stuff up, you know, a lot of times that's your cue that he is.
Yeah.
Well, that's why, like in a debate, or if he was in a blogospheric debate,
mm-hmm.
he would be laughed out of the debate because he'd be exposed. So it's a danger. The guys, the fact that he is, frankly, the leader of the Republican Party.
Yes.
He's the leader of the right-wing opposition.
Yes.
I would argue that he had pretty much attained that status in the 90s.
Yes, he got Reagan. He got Reagan elected.
Yeah, no, he grew. He went national in the late 80s.
Yeah, that's right. He got Bush elected. Yes,
right. By the early 90s,
he,
you know, he there was a remember when the Clintons brought out their health care reform, which wasn't a great reform. But they brought out their health care reform, and the Republican leadership in the Congress. This is so. It's so parallel to what's just happened here in, you know, Limbaugh claiming that the Republican leaders in the Congress aren't standing up to Obama. In the early 90s, you know, there were a bunch of Republicans that said, look, we know that there's a health care crisis, and we're going to look at the Clinton's plan and try to figure out a solution. Well, that's what the Republican leaders in the Congress said, but that wasn't Limbaugh's position. Limbaugh's position was, there's no health care crisis. We have got the best health care system in the world, bar none. And in a period of about 3 or 4 months, that became the national Republican leadership position.
Mm.
And he imposed it on them. Anyone who said, yeah, we have a health care crisis, but I'm not happy with the Clinton's reform, was just swept aside and had to change their position. In a sense, had to apologize to Limbaugh back then. And remember, it's 15 years ago. So what we've been seeing now, where any leading Republican who doesn't take the Limbaugh line has to apologize for it within a day or two, that's something we started seeing in about 93, 94. And I think that it really says something about, you know, the state of the two parties, that we have a very timid Democratic Party leadership where Obama felt the need on the weekend to call the New York Times and say, hey, all of my actions are completely consistent with free market principles.
Yeah,
unquote.
I saw that. I got shocked when I saw that.
Yeah, well, he felt the need to call them. And here we've had a complete collapse of the corporate free deregulated corporate capitalist system. And he's claiming that none of his reforms will go outside of the box of that. So you have that on the one hand. And then you have a Republican Party that's basically led by a charlatan like Limbaugh, who makes stuff up, who can't debate, who's just a demagogue. And it really shows you why our country's political system is in trouble, with that one bright spot that I always want to emphasize, and thank you for allowing me to do it, this growth of the independent media, the growth of progressive bloggers, the growth of Democracy Now!, that kind of, you know, that's the saving grace here, that dissenting views are getting out, and they're getting out to more millions of people because the independent media is just stronger now than it was 10, 15, 20
And this radio program, too.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to just ask you one final question, Jeff Cohen, as we're almost out of time. Where is Rush Limbaugh's Joseph Nye Wilch?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. I mean, when we put out our book on Limbaugh in like the mid-90s, almost no one had taken him on up until that point. Indeed, Tim Russert, Ted Koppel, they all, you know, we have quotes of them in our book about how Rush Limbaugh, he really does his homework. they would say. And so, you know, at this point, you know, the mainstream media, as always, and I talked about this earlier as a legacy of the Joe McCarthy era, and you bring up Welch, there's this feeling that if you go too tough on the right wing, then someone will accuse you of liberal bias, and that could hurt you with your boss, you see, with your corporate boss.
Describe what Joseph Welch did, Jeff Cohen, to McCarthy.
Welch was the lawyer at the Army McCarthy hearings. He was representing the U.S. Army, and he stood up to Joe McCarthy on national TV and said, "Have you no shame, Mr. Senator?" And it was like someone had finally found a backbone to speak up against the demagogue, Joe McCarthy.
Mm.
And again, it's so obvious that with Limbaugh in the news, you know it from your perch, that, you know, Limbaugh is such a huge player today, as big as he's ever been, that, you know, you'd think someone on ABC News might devote 4 minutes or 5 minutes to just this guy's reign of error, which was the subtitle of our book on Limbaugh. It would be so easy to just go through the history of Limbaugh, and just no one does it.
Well, it will come. I feel quite sure about that. Jeff Cohen, just tell us who published your latest book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media.
The latest book is published by a new independent publisher called Polypoint Press. If you want to get any of my books, including the Limbaugh book that we put out in the 90s, my website is jeffcohen.org, jeffcohen.org.
Okay, so people will be able to find as much information as they need from your website, correct?
Yes, and they'll be able to click on any of the book jackets and,
yes,
and get the book right off the website.
Yes, well, I want to thank you very much for an absolutely fascinating interview, Jeff.
Thank you, Helen.
And we'll have you on, you know, probably in a year's time to give a background briefing about what's happened over the year.
And I'll make a prediction that independent media will be stronger than ever.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Jeff.
The bad news is, will the economic collapse,
oh,
you know, have snowed us in.
I know.
All right, thanks so much, Helen.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My interview today was with media critic Jeff Cohen, who's founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's also an associate professor of journalism. He founded the media group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, in 1986. Thank you for listening today to If You Love This Planet. I think it's been quite fascinating and revealing. And we'll talk to you next week at the same time. Still out.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.